if Steph Curry decided to retire tomorrow so that he could become the Carolina Panthers' full-time mascot, how would you rank his career if he never played another day again?
Welcome on to a special edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. ESPN did a project about a month ago on the all-time NBA rank, which proved to be very controversial, very informative. And I wanted to bring in two of the people most instrumental in that project's success. First of all, Royce Webb, one of the big voices for analytics at ESPN. And also Kevin Pelton from ESPN as well has done a ton of work on all-time rankings in various pieces. How are you doing, gentlemen?
Very well, thanks.
Good, thanks for having us on.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on. And Royce, you've been really running this project at ESPN now, NBA Rank, since 2008, right?
Well, NBA Rank started in 2011 during the lockout when we were looking for a series that people would enjoy during the lockout because it was such a depressing few months. And we were looking for something. You know, we saw on Twitter that all we were seeing were updates on which player may or may not go to some other country and whether there might or might not be talks to resolve the stalemate. So we thought, okay, you know, what people want is basketball. What can we provide?
And what people want is rankings.
Well, I've noticed that too. So, and I thought for years, like, I'd love to do a project that involved, like, every single player in the NBA. What would that be? And it all kind of, all the threads came together. I'd already built the foundation for it by building a panel starting in 2008 because I wanted to experiment with wisdom of crowds and see whether the predictive accuracy was as good as I thought it might be. It turned out to be pretty spectacular. So we decided to extend the predictive element to the descriptive element of opinion. 2011, yep. We started NBA Ranked. We actually changed the question to a predictive question in 2013 because we actually thought that would be better. So NBA Rank itself is predictive. Of course, all-time NBA Rank, not quite as predictive because you're looking back. But, you know, I think the same logic applies, and our experts that we work with at Microsoft Research have agreed with that premise essentially and have helped us since 2012 to refine our techniques, build on all the work that we've done before. So they love NBA Rank, and they just have helped us improve it since then. So that's the background and how that it got started out of desperation in 2011, and it caught on so big with all the players retweeting and thanking us and all this stuff that we ultimately have done it now for 5 years.
Yeah, didn't Kent Bazemore he was ranked last or something? They put the number on his shoes. There's been some pretty crazy stuff. So am I allowed to reveal that I was a panelist on this most recent one?
Oh, no, you're not. Yes, you're allowed to reveal. we opened the new ballot style made me think differently about it, whereas a smaller panel worked previously. The new ballot style, I knew I needed a lot of votes. We needed thousands of votes. So I thought, okay, I need to be a little more expansive here.
Who is someone who has tons of time and will just get down the rabbit
hole?
You're
on the short, list of people who I thought would actually volunteer and do it. So,
I was going for who has opinions on the 12th man on the Hawks versus the 12th man on the Jazz.
Well, it was, I mean, just doing the regular NBA rank was really hard for me when you get into, you know, how do you compare the 200th and 300th best player in the league? I mean, and that's when you're at the top, you kind of have more outliers. It's a little bit difficult. You know, the difference between, I think, the first and second best player in the league is much greater than it is for, you know, the 200th and 201st best player in the league. And then as we got into the all time, that was even more, you know, it just was so difficult to rank guys who are further down the list. So can you explain just, you know, what the voters would see as they would bring up to vote, like what that interface was like?
Yeah, so we use now what's called a pairwise ballot, which essentially means you're given two choices. The choices might be Michael Jordan and LeBron James. They might be, you know, LeBron James and Kobe Bryant in some cases. They might be Kareem versus Larry Bird, you know, whatever. and it just keeps coming up over. You vote, and it gives you another pair, and so it just keeps coming up over and over again. We were actually encouraged to use this by our consultants at Microsoft Research. They are professionals in this field, and they thought that this actually would be a more accurate and robust way to do it. We started using it. They asked me to start experimenting with it last year to see how it worked, and it worked well for MBE Rank and some other projects that we did. I'm actually working with a lot of editors across ESPN to use this ballot style all the time now. So it's being used, you know, at least once a month, twice a month at ESPN.com for a lot of lists that people see that they don't know how they were put together. But a lot of times it's the pairwise balloting. It works kind of like the ELO system. And,
sure.
So it creates these head-to-head rivalries, and then it predicts what you would say. And then if you say something that it doesn't expect, then it factors that in and so forth. So it is a way to create both a fun ballot and better results.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Kevin.
Oh, no, I had nothing there.
We've reached our first edit point.
My bad.
So Royce and Kevin too, what is really the question that you want to answer when you're talking about rating all-time players? You know, there are a lot of ways you could look at it. You could look at total value. You could look at peak value. And as I recall, really the question was kind of phrased in a way to just let whoever the voter was kind of just decide what they thought was more important.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I'm kind of interested in, I mean, it's been a while since Kevin and I talked about this, so I'm kind of interested in his point of view now that he's gone through it all and seen the results. But I would say that the question that we drilled down to, and we thought of a lot of different versions of the questions. I consulted with Kevin and others on it. And ultimately, the question was, who is the greater player? Because I thought that's really what people would want to know. I also thought that it would get us away from, there's a certain built-in bias toward sort of lifetime achievement or respect issues. So I wanted to get away from that a little bit and allow people to think about it just in terms of, you know, what people want to know, which of these players is greater. And, you know, so that helped, I think, the voters to focus and factor in peak in a way that they might not have if we said something like who had the greater career, because that then implies some sort of longevity or whatever. Kevin takes a little bit of a different point of view on it, so he might have a different take on what the question could have been.
I mean, I think our main point of disagreement was really just what you do with current players, whether there's any sort of projection for what they're going to do in the future, or the way I viewed it is, you know, if Steph Curry decided to retire tomorrow so that he could become the Carolina Panthers' full-time mascot, how would you rank his career if he never played another day again?
All right, we have a new sponsor, Postmates. I mentioned before that the way I've been trying to get sponsors is taking services that I already used and really enjoyed, thinking that I would be an excellent spokesperson for them, and Postmates has responded. Postmates basically is an app that enables anyone to get anything delivered under 1 hour in all major U.S. cities, and they can deliver from anywhere. So if you want to get Chipotle, you want to get Walgreens, McDonald's, 7-Eleven, whatever it is, we always use it on football Sundays when we're hanging out. In fact, all of our stupid football bets are, the stakes are that the person who loses has to buy Postmates for that day, pretty much any major restaurant. And the best thing is Postmates deliveries are only $3.99 for the best restaurants. And the even more best thing is that if you download the Postmates app on iTunes or Android and enter that familiar CapSpace code, all one word, you get a free first delivery. It's basically a $10 credit that'll cover that first delivery. And remember to enter that CapSpace code. The Postmates app will revolutionize the way that you get stuff delivered.
Yeah, that's, I mean, and so is that how, for, and I guess you can just kind of make that decision if you were a voter, right? Are you going to project that, all right, this is what he's doing this year, we'll presume he's going to have a normal aging curve, maybe he gets hurt a little bit, but probably not, you know, that sort of thing, or whether you want to just cut it off immediately right there. I kind of just went with the latter approach in my own rankings, and, you know, so I was obviously a panelist, I assume Kevin was as well. And what was there, do you feel like there was enough diversity, Royce, in the panel? Like, what type of people were you able to get to do it? Because one of the things that I noticed in the rankings, which don't worry, we'll get beyond this process stuff soon enough, was that some of the kind of analytics favorites fared better than I feel like they kind of do in conventional wisdom.
All right, so in putting together the panel in the past, you know, I went to basically everybody who touches NBA content at ESPN, and that includes people on the TV side and radio side, and they don't all vote, you know. A lot of times I would get voters who were already associated with ESPN.com. We obviously have a strong analytics thread that goes back, you know, to John Hollinger and through Kevin and Tom, and really threads through all of our coverage, and even, you know, even the regular news reporters now are, you know, conversant. They understand the teams are picking this up and they're conversant in analytics. So it's a big part of everything that we do. I noticed NBA rank over the years, I thought in some cases was a little slow to pick up on some analytics observations. So I made sure that we had enough people who spoke the language, but at the same time, I've never really wanted NBA rank to mimic, what an algorithm would say. You know, as Kevin will tell you, the algorithms, have to be tweaked too. You know, they need sometimes a certain amount of, human input, as well. Today we, you know, tomorrow we're publishing his, draft rankings, which include, scouting input, as part of the consideration. So, I never really wanted it to be doctrinaire in one way or the other. You're picking up on that because analytics is such a powerful force right now that among the people, you know, among the voters out there who I have recruited are people like you who have an eye on what the analytics say. But it's not really about getting it to mimic it. It was just trying to make it as smart as possible.
Were you able to get any older people who had really like seen some of these older players play? And, you know, I think just generally you would also say, I'm sure there are plenty of older people who are into analytics, but just generally if you look at the demographics, probably younger people are more into that kind of stuff. I mean, did you feel like you had decent diversity, just kind of diversity from kind of an age standpoint?
We have diversity from a lot of standpoints. I mean, we have, you know, a great diversity of points of view across the campus. We have diversity from a racial standpoint. We have some women who are on the panel and so forth. Age is a little tougher. You know, we do, I won't call out all the older voters, but we have one who was responsible for Total Basketball and he's, you know, a historian of the game. And I made sure that he voted. I wanted his opinion as part of this. You know, we're, you know, generally speaking, the wisdom of crowds works with more information. I wanted his opinion as part of this. I'm sure he was an influence because I asked him to participate. He ranked his top 100 before he voted. Then he voted on that, and his list would look very different from somebody who's 25 years old, probably. So he was part of it. I could name a few other people who were. But, you know, we don't have a high concentration of 60 and over fans or people in the company or, you know, NBA observers, frankly, these days.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you know, because that's, I think, the number one criticism that a lot of people would say of this list is, hey, you know, you're ranking Oscar Robertson, you never saw this guy play, you know, but, I mean, on the other hand, it's not like those people are just running around and, like, getting ready to vote in complex polls either. So,
to be fair, Oscar Robertson's never seen Steph Curry play, so that's fair.
And it's funny, actually, to foreshadow a little bit, I think I'm going to be a little bit higher on Oscar than some other people were. So let's start off here. I mean, talking about what the rankings were, I'll just say read off what your guys' rankings were. Jordan was 1, Kareem 2, LeBron 3, Magic 4, Wilt 5, Bird 6, Russell 7, Tim Duncan 8, Shaquille O'Neal 9, Hakeem 10. For you guys, just personally, your own observations, how does that differ with what you guys have thought the ranking should be?
Kevin, go ahead.
I mean, I think that's 9 of my personal top 10, so it's pretty similar. I think it's more some of the fine distinctions at the top. You know, how do you handle Bill Russell is a very difficult one. Magic and Larry, the fact that they had relatively short careers, those two guys, I think, are points of contention. But, you know, I don't think overall it's so different.
Yeah, well, so who is missing from the top 10 for you? And who is out?
I mean, one thing we should probably talk about at some point here is the championships added metric that I put together.
Kind of a starting point for
my personal rankings, which used win shares going back throughout basically all of NBA history, I think to like 1947, 48, and looking at regular season success, playoff success, and then awards, and you know, figure out if you're a player that has a 15 win shares, what are the odds that your team wins the championship? How about for 5 win shares, and so on and so forth, which tends to indicate that those, you know, extremely good seasons, those MVP caliber seasons, are much more valuable, are worth, you know, 3 or 4 all-star seasons, as opposed to if you look at raw win shares, they might only be worth, you know, 1 or 2 of those, that sort of thing. So that probably places a premium on peak performance. But the one guy who was in the top 10 there, who is not all that close actually to the NBA ranked top 10, is Karl Malone, who regular season performance I think stands with almost anyone in all time, obviously, but then the playoff performance drags him down quite a bit.
You know, it's funny that that's the way you looked at it, as sort of championships added and absolute awesome seasons kind of seem to be at a premium there in your ranking. I've kind of looked at it the same way. The way I looked at it was, all right, if I'm going to get this person for his whole career, it's not just, all right, who's going to add the most value in terms of win shares or whatever metric you want to use. For me, it was, I want to get this guy at the start of my career, or the start of his career, and my goal is I want my team to win as many championships as possible with this player. And it so that was sort of how I thought about it subjectively, and it seems like your metric was pretty much in the same vein.
Right, and I think the way I think about it, you know, you probably conceive it more is, if I have him from the start of his career, to me it's like if you ran this guy's career 10,000 times in a variety of different settings with different teammates, different eras, things like that, how would it go? So like Malone is a tough one, I think, for people to differentiate, because they're like, championships added, he didn't win any championships, how could he have added any championships? But obviously that was no small part because he faced Michael Jordan and the Bulls twice in the finals. If Malone comes along maybe 5 years later isn't the right period, because that probably puts him in line with the Kobe Shaq Lakers. But if he comes along 10 years later at a period where the champions weren't so strong, you know, then his career might end up totally different in terms of what it results in at the championship level.
Yeah, Royce, how about you? Was there anyone that you looked at who really surprised you that they were that high and just in the way you'd conceptualize it coming in?
The two names I had my eye on the most were LeBron and Steph Curry. Steph Curry's down the list, but in terms of the top 10.
Yeah, he's 23rd,
so
yeah.
In terms of the top 10, I have to say that, you know, while Kevin has a theoretical framework that he's working with, I'm looking at it also as an editor, you know, who's publishing this, and I, you know, I have interest in how it's going to be received and et cetera. So, I was watching the result. We were getting results every couple of days. The guys at Microsoft were actually sort of handling the back end for us, and they were sending me spreadsheets every couple of days. And LeBron was running number 2 for quite a while, and I thought that was how it was going to end up. That may be a case where our older voters, our more traditional voters, helped Kareem at the last in the last few days. But so LeBron thing became a question. I was, you know, Dan Patrick had me on recently and suggested that, you know, Larry Bird should have been higher than LeBron and so forth. So I think LeBron is definitely a lightning rod, but I think that he does well by every standard, especially now that he's got 2 championships. I think people, you know, give him some demerits for not winning more, perhaps in his, 6 opportunities. But I think he was the one I watched most closely. The rest of them, if you look at how they, you know, I think I sent you the ratings. If you look at the ratings, most of them are pretty close to each other.
Right.
So it's, you know, whether Bird belongs ahead of Russell, they're within a point or so of each other. So it's not that big a difference. You know, we don't make a big deal of the rating because fans actually don't care very much about the ratings. They just care about the rating.
Yeah.
But I don't think we even published him in this case, although we have published him in past years for NBA rank. So the LeBron thing was the most interesting to me because here we have a contemporary player. We don't know what's going to happen the rest of his career. He is a bit of a controversial figure, and he's 3rd all time. But you can make a heck of a case for him being number 2 all time, or
Yeah,
and
I think
in a time travel sense, being the best player we've ever seen. So,
yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I kind of looked at it in tiers when I went through and did my top 10. And I thought that Jordan and LeBron were the top tier for me. Maybe you could make the argument that Jordan should be even in his own tier above LeBron. But I felt like LeBron is clearly kind of ahead of that next group. So, Kevin, what do you think? Would you have had LeBron James as the second best player of all time?
I would have, yeah. I think he's gotten to that point now. He's been in the league long enough that he's close to putting up career value statistics. He just passed Jordan in terms of career value over replacement player from the box plus minus metric on basketballreference.com. When you look at that plus the height of his peak in terms of, you know, the span where he won MVP basically every year, got to the finals basically every year, I think he does belong there.
Yeah, I agree as well. What do you guys think the argument is for Kareem being ahead of him? I actually would have had Kareem probably like fifth or so, I think, in my own personal rankings.
Yeah, I think the argument becomes that Kareem can win an argument with basically everyone, depending on how you weight things. If you want to weight things, you know, towards peak, he's got a peak that's right up there with anyone. And then longevity, he surpasses pretty much everyone. So there's no one who both has had a better peak and more longevity than Kareem. I think that's where he benefits in my
opinion. To restate what Kevin just said in somewhat different terms, one reason you use a ballot like this and a panel like this is that in wisdom of the crowd, you're trying to pick up a little knowledge from everybody and combine it all, right? There's no foolproof system out there. You know, Kevin has his method. Others, you know, would not consider LeBron top five. As I said, I just talked to somebody who's observed the game for a long time and worked in the NBA space for a long time who doesn't have LeBron as higher than Larry Bird. So I think to talk a little bit about what Kevin just said, a lot of people are going to automatically have Kareem very high based on both those things. He dominated the game with 6 MVPs and 6 titles, and yet he did it for forever. And even before that, you know, I don't know if anyone factored this in, but before that, he also revolutionized college basketball somewhat. So, you know, he's as iconic as anyone, and I think more voters saw that and brought that, you know, to his credit, which got him just a little bit above LeBron, even though LeBron is a bigger talent in some ways.
For me, the thing about Kareem, and obviously there's no one right way to do this, but personally, looking at it as, all right, you know, how many seasons did this guy have where he was just an unbelievable championship-level player? And, you know, certainly all of his Bucks years would qualify for that, right? And, you know, I think when he was 26, 27, it's when he got traded to the Lakers during the 74-75 season. But then really, once he was on the Lakers, that Western Conference was pretty mediocre in all of those years until Magic arrived. And he really was not able to make them to be a championship contender during those years. And basically, from when he got to L.A. until the end, they never really had an elite defense either. And I think you would have to conclude that he, and this is certainly backed up by anecdotal points, especially in the 80s, that really like his defense and rebounding really kind of declined once he went to L.A. And that was one of the big reasons I decided to kind of move him down the list a little bit, that it wasn't until Magic got there that they really got back into championship contention.
I mean, I think the counterpoint is he still led the league in win shares 5 of the first 6 seasons he was in with the Lakers, and in box plus minus value over replacement player his first 5 seasons. Even the year that Walton won MVP and Kareem missed 20 games that year, that was when he broke his hand in a punch, still had more value over replacement player in the best box plus minus in the league that year ahead of Walton.
Yeah, although Walton also, I think, missed 20 games that year as well. Yeah. But I agree. And maybe that's unfairly penalizing him for having bad teammates during that time. You probably would be hard-pressed, frankly, to name someone who is any good who was on those Laker teams before Magic got there that you really think of as, you know, anywhere close to a championship-level player. So that certainly is a reasonable point, but I think LeBron's peak, and also I guess the next question too that we can talk about, and Royce, you can weigh in on this too, is, you know, did you guys, in thinking about this, adjust at all for era? Did you give any more credit to modern players? I admit that I kind of did.
I'll say this, and I think Kevin may come a different perspective. I have a decent sized bias in favor of modern players. I think it's they are building on everything that's happened in the past, so they are often more skilled, and they also are coming from a much bigger pool of potential players. I mean, basically, unlike in the 50s and 60s, 70s maybe, around the world and all across the U.S., if you want to play basketball, you can pretty much, and if you're any good, you will emerge. That's a pretty powerful argument for the modern players being better. And, you know, this is an imperfect analogy, but I think of it as you look back at TV shows from the 70s, even the best TV shows, very thin plots and, you know, and now you watch a show and they're incredibly complex and all this. I think, you know, when you watch Steph Curry play, you realize this is an evolutionary game. So LeBron the same way. So I had no problem with our system and our voters giving the benefit of the doubt to the modern player.
I mean, I think that Bill Simmons basically used that exact same analogy in the Book of Basketball, except about comedy, right?
Oh, well, it fits. It fits, no doubt. It doesn't fit every genre. Music, you know, you're not always sure it fits in every genre. But I think in comedy, I think in some, you know, scripted dramas and that kind of thing. But I think in basketball the same way. I mean, these guys have been going to camps. These guys have been learning. They've been learning from their dads, apparently. They've watched Michael Jordan, you know, everything that they've seen before, they're able to incorporate, stretch the limits of the game. So it feels right to me. And it doesn't feel right to me to honor an era where, in many cases, African Americans did not even have equal opportunities.
Yeah, especially even until like the late 60s was the first time that you really saw black players from the South getting much of a chance even. So it wasn't really until the 70s, I think, that in the U.S. it was as inclusive. And then you talked about, obviously, that the international game has grown so much. And I think, you know, players just play more. They lift weights more. They practice more. I mean, I think that just they're many shots that today's players hit that just yesterday's players like couldn't even dream of hitting. Now, maybe if you warp them into today and they had that kind of training and that sort of stuff, then maybe you can make the argument. And I think that kind of takes away the adjustment a little bit. But I think if I was in a case where, for me, all things being equal, I would skew towards the modern player in my personal evaluation.
So to me, I think there are kind of two different trains of thought here. And one is sort of what you were starting to touch on, the time machine element. If we took a player from one era and put them to another era, how would they perform? I'm not as interested in that one personally, even though we're going to discuss it. I mean, I think it's a fun discussion. I think it's a fun discussion.
Well, hopefully our listeners feel differently,
yeah.
Kevin.
I think it's a fun discussion, but I ultimately think it's so subjective that it's unfair to really evaluate players that way. So to me, the way that I look at it is, how well did you do relative to the league? What is the strength of the league relative to where it is now? And there, you know, there are ways of showing statistically that the league has gotten better over time because of the many reasons that Royce pointed out here. And it's consistent with what I've found in terms of, you know, the ratio of the population that's potentially available to play in the NBA to how many spots or how many teams at least are in the NBA, all of those things. So I think there is a timeline effect, but I apply it equally to everyone who played in the NBA in 1962. Not differently to someone whose athleticism would have translated as opposed to, or someone who the rules favored at that particular time.
I mean, Kevin's more fair-minded than I am. I'm really interested in, you know, who's doing it the best. You know, what's the best version of this? And in many cases, we're seeing that today. That's not entirely true. You know, I mean, certainly, you know, Barkley is a unique figure, or John Stockton is a unique figure, and these skills and talents would translate well to now. But I am interested in, you know, Bill Russell's shooting percentage does catch my eye, and it wasn't good.
All right, so I want to give you guys my next tier of guys in order, and I just want to, you guys can react and maybe give me yours as well. All right, so third best player of all time, I had Magic Johnson. Then I had Wilt Chamberlain, Kareem, Tim Duncan, and Larry Bird. That was rounding out my second tier. So that takes us through the top seven all time.
Well, I mean, the first one that's obviously missing to me is Bill Russell, who I think I'm even higher on than the NBA rank panel, who was much higher on Russell than you are.
Yeah, so this is my thinking on leaving Russell out. I mean, we had to get to this at some point. You've noted that his teams were first on defense every year but one. I mean, if you look at his stats, there aren't a ton of advanced stats available from those days, but he was a pretty inefficient offensive player, you know, not especially when you consider that he was a center, probably, you know, much more athletic really than just about anyone he was going up against in that time period, other than maybe Wilt for most of his career. And you know, he still shot a really poor percentage from the field. And you could say, all right, you know, that's just an artifact of the era. And he certainly was an unbelievable defensive player. Like, I'm saying that he's probably, you know, pretty close to the best defensive player ever, if not the best. But you want to guess how many above average offenses Bill Russell played on in his career?
Well, I already looked at the notes, so I probably should refrain.
The answer is one. And I think that, yeah, he was an awesome defensive player. Those teams, I mean, I think he also benefits a little bit from them just getting lucky, frankly, in his historical legacy, and just the fact that there are so few teams, and it probably wasn't as hard to win a championship back then as well. I mean, not
probably,
to diminish 11 championships in 13
years. Probably, eight teams?
Yeah.
It was very much simpler path, right?
I mean, it definitely wasn't as hard, but I think when you look at everything we know about Russell's career from a subjective standpoint, everything we know about the Celtics' performance from an objective standpoint, you know, there were teams that played their best basketball in the playoffs on a continual basis, that when the leverage of the game was most important in terms of, you know, game seven of a playoff series, the finals, things like that, they tended to perform at their best in those moments. And his selflessness, his willingness to fill the role that the Celtics needed to play without any consideration to individual ego, having a team ego instead of an individual ego. To me, I think that, you know, obviously there is an element of luck that you won the championship every single year, but the reason that they were in position to do it basically every single year is primarily to me about Bill Russell.
And I do think he and Tim Duncan to me are probably, you'd have to look at them as like the two best teammates and leaders of all time. I think like pretty much anyone else that you look at has some flaws in that regard. I mean, Jordan punched teammates, Larry Bird, you know, supposedly punched a guy during the 85 playoffs and didn't play that well after that. I mean, you know, Magic Johnson got a coach fire. I mean, you can go down the list of some of the rest of these guys that are all kind of more flawed as personalities, or I think Tim Duncan and Bill Russell are the two that you would never even hear the slightest bad word about. And also, they had tremendous relationships with their coaches, and that allowed those coaches to do their job. Those guys were willing to be coached. They didn't have egos. Same, you know, Tim Duncan with Greg Popovich, obviously. Greg talks about that all the time, that Tim is willing to be coached, and that sets the culture for the team. So I do think that those two things, those superstars being such great leaders, is something that deserves a lot of credit.
And in his credit, I mean, the way he played was innovative in its own way. I mean, it was something that dominated in a new way and was spectacular in a new way. I think that gets factored in. He finished seventh. That's a strong finish.
Yeah, I would have had him, you know, probably like early teens, something like that. But yeah, I mean, so Kevin, you disagree on that one. Is there anything else of that list that you you feel anyone should be higher or lower?
You didn't have Shaq in that tier, right?
No, I moved him down a little bit. I into the next tier with Hakeem Olajuwon, Oscar Robertson, and Jerry West.
And to me, there was enough of a period where obviously he had Kobe as a teammate and he had Phil Jackson as a coach. But to me, during those 3 years, the Lakers three-peated. Having Shaq basically guaranteed you a good chance of winning a championship.
Yeah, you know, I probably
never had a period like that.
Yeah,
I mean, Hakeem obviously did win a couple championships with much weaker talent, but I still think Shaq was so far ahead of everyone else at that point that to me, he's in that second tier.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Actually, I should move him up because I mean, if I was going to say that Bird won three MVPs in a row, Shaq should have won three MVPs in a row for sure.
Shaq gets demerits too, though. The fact that he did contribute to, you know, a good number of problems with two franchises at least, right? Maybe
sure.
Maybe three. The fact that he was unreliable. I'm pretty sure that was factored in. You know, people talk about the end of Kobe's career. Like, oh, well, he can't hurt his legacy now. Well, turns out he can, and he did this year probably. And we're going to remember some of this as part of who he is. And I think Shaq has a little bit of that problem. He did peak very high and probably has peaked as a top five player, but you know, he didn't always have that. There's a reason he won only one MVP award is he just didn't show up for 82 games for various reasons.
And because of an insane vote for Allen Iverson. That's the other reason.
Well, there is that.
I mean, yeah, well, and Shaq is kind of a unique figure in this, and maybe you could say that Chamberlain, to a lesser extent, this applies to in terms of moving around so much over the course of his career. Abdul-Jabbar is the only – well, I'm not counting Jordan's Wizards thing. Abdul-Jabbar and LeBron are the only two other guys that changed teams at all out of this, you know, first or second tier of players. And in Shaq's case, sometimes it was by choice that he got traded. So he's definitely, I think, unique in that regard among this group. And I don't think that the panel necessarily had him very underrated, but I do think you have to have him in this tier.
Yeah, Shaq, you make a great point because guys like Akeem, Oscar, Jerry West, I mean, in their best seasons, they weren't winning championships a lot of the time. I mean, Akeem a couple in what was, I think a lot of people would say was a little bit weaker of a league during that period. And Shaq, it was, you know, Bird, Tim Duncan, Kareem, Wilt, you know, say what you will about him, but he was a driving force on two of the best teams of all time. I think he didn't bring it every year, I think, especially on defense, but Magic, obviously, also, like, his teams were number one in offense basically every year that he played for the Lakers. I mean, so those guys, that is, I think, a good way to differentiate between these tiers, where it's like, all right, if this guy is at the peak of his powers, you are either in the finals or you are winning a championship most every year. But, you know, that's probably oversimplifying in terms of teammates. But nonetheless, I think that's kind of how you have to do it.
On the other hand, he was swept out of the playoffs an inordinate number of times. So, you know, it wasn't it was short of a guarantee.
How do you guys see Wilt? I had him as the fourth best player. I had him ahead of Kareem. What are your thoughts on him? Is that too high for him? He was number five in the ESPN rankings.
So I had him fifth behind Kareem and Russell, and I could definitely see an argument for Duncan over him too. I mean, I think, you know, what makes Wilt challenging is, first off, if all you're going on is box score stats, which is we're lucky to even have what we have from Wilt's career,
right,
which is points rather, rebounds, and shooting percentage is basically it, and free throws. So those are always going to favor Wilt, because I think no one, at least among the great players in NBA history, has had more of their value tied up in what they did in the box score than Wilt Chamberlain, and less value in terms of non-box score things. So I think that probably puts him too high. He's second in my championships added because of that. And then the other factor, and Mark Hobner, who is very strong on historical stuff and still tweets at M. Hobbs, even though he's no longer running the Painted Area blog, which I miss dearly, has kind of swayed me on the fact that when you look at the highest leverage situations, to go back to that phrase that I used with Bill Russell, Chamberlain tended to come up small at those moments. And that's something that can't quite fully be captured in the win shares model that I put together for the playoffs, because although we're, you know, counting how you did in the playoffs, it's the first round still counts as much as game seven of the finals. And if you kind of account for that in terms of championship leverage, I think Russell is going to come out much better and Chamberlain is going to come out much worse.
Royce, what do you think of Wilt?
You know, just a unique figure, obviously. I think, like Oscar, he presents a problem in that the numbers are so big that we don't know exactly what to do with them, you know, in our minds. I think that it's kind of handy that he did come up short in championships. It allows people to, it makes it more interesting, allows people to process his success and, you know, in some kind of way. Because otherwise I think that people would just default to him being the number one player, of all time. And I doubt that's accurate. Especially if we factor in, the generational factors like we talked about. But if you watch the highlights, I mean, there's never been anybody like Wilt. Exactly. You know, as excited as we are about Ben Simmons, he's not even that, you know, who reminds me of Wilt as an athlete, I should say. He's not even as big as Wilt. So, it's a unique figure. I think, the way Chamberlain and Russell worked out has given us, decades of, something to talk about rather than it just being a clear A and B, first place, second place decision. Even here, you know, the voters differ slightly from Kevin's opinion.
I guess one thing I'd say is, like, if you were giving me control of, like, if you were giving me the choice of stepping into any player for the course of their career, I mean, Jordan would be pretty fun to play his career.
For the course of their on-court career, right?
Well, that's another question. But, I mean, if you got to put me into Wilt's body and, like, be a good teammate, and hopefully, I probably would choke in the playoffs much more than Wilt did. But, you know, from that standpoint, like, if you could control it, he's got the most potential, but in terms of what he actually achieved, I don't think he's got the most.
I mean, so if you're an NBA GM in 1960, would you rather have Russell on your team or Wilt on your team?
Russell.
Yeah. I mean, I think you also have to consider that I think Chamberlain, when he had good coaching, I think that he did better. And the fact that he was able to play on these two all-time great teams, I agree with you that I don't think that ultimately he did that good a job of being consistent, and he had some years where the defenses that he played on weren't that good. But when he did really focus on team play, you know, like when he led the league in assists and they had a really good defense on that 66-67 Sixers team, I thought he just had a little bit higher of a peak than someone like Russell. What do you guys think of Magic? I mean, he was number four in these rankings. That was a little bit higher than I expected to see him. You know, for example, like Bill Simmons' Book of Basketball had Magic down at like the 7-8 range. I can't remember exactly where.
Let me guess. Was he below Bird?
No, he was above Bird. That was like how Bill established his legitimacy of being objective.
Yeah.
I guess I should read it. So, you know, I grew up with Magic as my favorite player, so I'm not sure. And you know, I will say that it's for people of my generation, probably more than for you two. It's not just that he put up numbers or you get one championships. That was fun as it happened. But, you know, he and to some degree Bird, and then them as a tandem especially, changed the game. I mean, right before our eyes, there's no two ways about it. They changed everything about the NBA. They really set it up for Michael Jordan. MJ came along and has sort of taken a lot of the credit and deserves some of the credit. But, you know, the game of the late 70s was pretty bad. And by the way, not on, you know, the finals weren't on live at night.
Yeah.
So it happened right before our eyes. We couldn't believe it as it was happening. It was the kind of thing that you wanted to see in basketball, and it was there, and it was a L.A.-Boston rivalry. I mean, you could not have dreamed it up much better. So for me, Magic is, you know, he's an easy top five call for me, but I'm a little biased on that.
How does he work by your numbers, Kevin?
Yeah, he's a little bit lower there, and I think one of the things that probably happens with Magic when you get him all the way up to fourth in a ranking like this is probably people are giving him credit for what he might have been able to do had he not been diagnosed with HIV, because, you know, I think that's the difference between him and Larry, is that, you know, because of the fact that it was an injury with Larry, he was declining, and then retired. Magic, you know, he wasn't at the peak of his game necessarily, but the previous year had led an otherwise not great Lakers team to the finals, was coming off of that, was still playing at basically an MVP level. And I think, you know, had he played a full healthy career, I think he'd be right up there in that, you know, discussion right now with LeBron and Kareem and Russell for, you know, the top two to four guys. But he didn't actually do that. And, you know, the lack of longevity, I think, hurts him more in my metric probably than it does in your mind.
Yeah, for me, I do give him a little credit, especially because even when he came back at like age 35, 36 in 1996, he was still pretty darn effective, even on a team that already had a point guard, and he wasn't playing point guard anymore. At that time, he was playing power forward. So I think if you kind of fill in the blanks between 1991 and 1996, you could say, you know, he probably would have aged pretty well. I mean, he was obviously that passing vision wasn't going to go anywhere. And he's clearly the best passer of all time. I think that's just not even close to an argument for me. But in looking at him too, though, I felt like even without that late career bonus for when he wasn't playing, I still think he's number four to me just because they were the number one offense every single year that he played, basically. I think there was one year that they were second until 91 when they finally dropped to fifth. But that's and I've always had Magic lower before I really started to look at this because some of his advanced box score stats don't quite add up as being as good as some of these other guys. But if you look at what his team was able to do on offense, I think that makes me think that, yeah, the effect he had on his team, and then also another guy who's just really well known as a great winner and leader, that pushed him a little bit higher than some of these other guys.
Nate, you mentioned filling out his career. I actually did this once using Shaney over at Basketball Prospectus, and he was projected for four more seasons of double-digit assists, two more seasons with 20-plus warp, and he came out as the all-time post-merger leader in wins above replacement player by my metric if you added in those seasons.
So one other guy I wanted to get to, and obviously we could have 10 podcasts on this as we go through every player and talk about him, but Oscar Robertson was a guy who I just kind of gave short shrift to, and the fact that he's such a curmudgeon lately, I mean, obviously deserves a ton of credit for his work and helping the players get free agency, but you don't really see very many highlights of him. There isn't great footage of him until he was with the Bucks towards the end of his career. I went back and looked at his team performance, and his teams were first in offense every single year, and I think you'd be hard-pressed to name a great player that he played with in Cincinnati. And, of course, they're last on defense every year of his prime, too. But, as a guard, I kind of view him as a little bit less responsible for that.
No, it seems reasonable. I mean, it probably worked to his benefit, the fact that they weren't that strong inside and that it was one of the factors that allowed him to average a triple-double and be that much of a presence on the glass. But, yeah, I mean, I definitely think that speaks well to your point guard, if you're number one in offense every year.
Yeah, what are your impressions of Oscar and his game, Royce, and where do you think he fits into this? You guys had him at number 11, one spot ahead of Kobe Bryant, and actually two ahead of Jerry West, which was a surprise to me.
It's very difficult for me to create an apples-to-apples comparison in my mind when somebody, we have very little on them. They didn't have the same kind of athleticism that we're used to, and they played in an era, like I said, that where opportunity was a lot more limited. So we're going back 55 years since his heyday, and it's hard for me to give him an apples-to-apples comparison, even though, as Kevin says, maybe we should just consider him, consider how dominant he was in his era. So I have no problem with him finishing 11th, right in there, but I do think that he gets overcredited for the triple-doubles, and if he didn't have that on his resume, right or wrong, he would be lower on the list.
I always thought of him as someone who, when I looked at the offensive performance of his teams, I actually expected it to be bad. I thought, like, oh, he's known as this guy who would just sort of back down to the foul line and shoot a jumper over guys. But he was really efficient, actually, and his teams scored really well despite not really having that great of players on them. So I think he was the one guy that I looked at that I was expecting to find something different about him, and I was very impressed with the way that his teams performed. I mean, if you're the point guard of the number one offense basically 10 years in a row, that deserves a lot of credit, especially when you consider some of the other great teams of that era and the fact that those were great teams that had superstars teaming up on them.
Kevin might shoot this down, but I think I'm a little bit as a forerunner of LeBron. We've seen LeBron at some of his best moments, like against OKC, where he'll play a bit of high post, maybe low post too, and he'll just dominate from that position, whether by scoring or in the mid-range and short game or by passing. And obviously Oscar's passing was probably the missing part of that equation that you just talked about.
No, I mean, I think that's reasonable. And the one thing that really hurts him in my model is the lack of playoff success, but it's not really, I think, something that's necessarily reflective of him. His own individual numbers were still pretty good in the playoffs. He just didn't have that much opportunity because of the teams he was on.
And then when he finally teamed up with Kareem, even at the end of his career, they immediately formed an all-time great team. That's one of the apples of your eye from that podcast we did about the greatest teams ever, that 70-71 Bucks team. The next thing I wanted to talk about is to put to you guys, who are the guys that really seem too high to you? I think we talked both about the top 10 already. What about in the top 25? Are there any guys that pop out to you that you just don't agree with the wisdom of crowds on this one?
Steph Curry.
He should be lower?
Yeah, I think so. If you go by the philosophy that I explained earlier where, you know, what if he retired tomorrow, then he's still too high. Now that we can pretty safely assume that he's going to win the MVP this year and can, you know, have one of the all-time great seasons, if not the all-time great season, it becomes a lot more justifiable. But I still don't think that, you know, two all-time great seasons, two pretty good seasons, and then, you know, not much else in terms of off-peak, I still don't think that puts you in the top 25.
Well, I never, I try to never disagree with Kevin, but I'll say I take a little bit different perspective on Curry, you know, because, and not just because the vote came out this way. I mean, I hoped he would finish well. Now, what we knew in November and December was not everything we know now, but it sure looked
like... I agree with you on that, yeah.
It sure looked like from opening night, essentially, the first quarter of the first game, that he was going to be great. By the time voters voted, it looked like if he stayed healthy, he was going to be the hands-down MVP. It looked like, as you, you know, they were undefeated during a lot of the stretch, so it looked like they were going to be the title favorites. Nothing about that has changed, so... You know, it was a little bit of risk taking by the voters, but they were pricing in another incredible season. And when you look at the players below him, I mean, Kevin has a point about career achievement. When you look at players below him, none of them, you know, none or few of them came close to reaching that peak that he's at. You know, the one we got the most flack about was not from Kevin, but from others, was Isaiah Thomas. And, Isaiah Thomas never finished higher than fifth in the MVP voting and never came close to finishing fifth again. So this is a completely different peak. Curry's, you know, revolutionizing some aspects of the game, changing the league. You don't have to factor all that in, but it's happening. And I think it would be, I think of it as almost unfair to take this vote and not have him this high. Because I think it would shortchange what he's accomplished, even though he's done it over a short period. A title is not nothing. A second MVP award, which our voters were kind of pricing in, is not nothing.
The greatest season of all time, potentially, is not nothing on potentially the greatest team of all time. I agree with you, and I think we all just like him so much, too, that we kind of just want him to be higher. I think if he really completes this year and has one of the greatest seasons of all time, maybe the greatest season of all time, I think he probably has gotten to the point where he'll have earned that ranking. Although I think it was, especially back then, was a little bit ambitious because there was kind of no reason to think he was that it would be possible for him to continue playing that well, and yet he still has.
This goes back also to the question on the ballot, who is the greater player? And he was winning head-to-head contests against the guys you see below him.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's eye of the beholder stuff. And I get that we're all caught up in he's likable or whatever. I would say this, another thing that is hard, and it's a difficult thing to know how to factor in or whether people ever should factor it in. Everybody who has ever played, I mean, you know, sort of the first thing you do is shoot, right? You know, you shoot. And here's a guy who comes along who is hitting the equivalent of 700-foot home runs. You know, I think that, you know, that is something that gets people's attention in a different way from, oh, he's a Dennis Rodman-esque rebounder, right? Because it's the most, you know, it's as fundamental a skill as there is, putting the ball up, scoring, and he's doing it better than anyone. So it's a really hard thing to factor in, but when we talk about peak, I mean, this guy defines it.
Yeah, of course, we should reveal that Royce is a little biased here. He's one of the better pickup shooters I've ever played with and really enjoys pulling up from about 30 feet and making them, obviously, against unsuspecting players. So, but nonetheless, I agree with a lot of those points, Royce. Kevin, you wrote a little bit about this when it came out that Isaiah was people were up in arms that he was only fifth on the point guard rankings, that 20 people were saying that 26 might even be too low for him. I think it is way too high. I suspect you are of the same mind.
Yes, it is safe to say. I mean, I think my process with Isaiah is a little similar to what you've discussed beforehand. You know, if Isaiah was the player that people think he was, why weren't his teams better offensively? Like, even the great Pistons teams that, you know, won back-to-back championships, which a little overrated historically, but that's neither here nor there. those teams won with defense. They didn't win because of the fact that they were great offensively. So why is so much of the value tied to the point guard and not to the guys that made their defensively?
It's the best player on the best team problem to some degree.
Yeah, and those teams just were very, very deep teams that won with defense. And it's sort of the same, although I think that Derrick Rose's MVP season was probably a better season than Isaiah ever had. But nonetheless, it's sort of that same thing at work where it's, all right, someone's got to get the credit here, and when it's defense, it's kind of hard to do that, and so it ends up being Isaiah. But you made the point that he was never higher than fifth in MVP voting. I mean, he made a ton of All-Star games, but also there really was no competition at guard in the East. You know, I mean, who else was even a point guard or even a guard that you look at as being anywhere close to an all-time great player other than MJ during that time period in the East? So I don't think he had a lot of competition there. He kind of benefited from that. And then he had a shorter career than a lot of guys did as well.
One thing I think we'll throw out that is a legitimate argument is that people look at his playoff performance, and he was much better. I have him, you know, if you break it up into the components, he's 158th in regular season championships added, but 57th in the playoffs. So he's a lot better there, but he's still not a top 25 guy or anywhere close.
We're hearing the other side of this generational discussion around Steph Curry, but I think if you look at the list here and how people reacted to it, the real flashpoint for the generational discussion was probably Isaiah, because I grew up when Isaiah was easily the most fascinating player in the league, and that's a league that included Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, and so forth. He was much discussed then. It was novel, some of the things, the way that Curry is novel now. Isaiah was novel then in terms of some of his ball handling and spectacular play. And he was, a controversial enough figure to be left off the dream team. But they won two championships. His toughness and grit was considered a key part of that. His leadership was considered a key part of that. So I think there's a people of another generation have a lot invested in Isaiah. And it really stung them when our voters just didn't see it that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of right. And Isaiah, just from an aesthetic standpoint, he also had that iconic Game 6 in that 1988 Finals against the Lakers when he had 43 points and sprained his ankle. I think that gets shown on ESPN Classic or NBA Hardwood Classics all the time. Anybody else that you guys thought were really overrated in this analysis?
I think Bill Walton is an interesting case here, because even in a method that I built to kind of reward peak performance over, to some extent, over longevity, he still doesn't come out even as a top 100 guy.
Again, I think an iconic player, and that goes back to his college days, and it's probably hard to separate all that out for people. So I think he's getting a lot of credit for a lot of things that aren't going to show up at Basketball Reference necessarily.
A guy for me that I thought was a little bit too high, this isn't even going to raise much ire by anyone. Bob Lanier at number 68, I thought was actually way too high. Sorry, it's almost like, oh, why are you piling on Bob Lanier of all these people?
Poor Bob.
Yeah. But it's like, I went back in the course of these. I probably spent, 7 or 8 hours going down the rabbit hole and neglecting the work I should have been doing. So thanks for that, Royce. But, I went back and tried to do as much research on these guys as I could. And Lanier, for a big guy, his teams really never won much, and they're always awful on defense. And so it really made it hard for me to think that, all right, and I don't think he was ever really particularly efficient offensively either.
Yeah.
And it was kind of subjectively a ground bound bruiser type big guy, maybe the forerunner of like a Greg Monroe sort of guy, both left hand. I think that's actually
one thing to know is you did your own homework, but we did provide a dossier for the voters. We provided a full statistical profile of each player, a lot of detail about what their accomplishments have been, some of the awards they won, win shares for 48. And we tried to provide all that. Now, in the case of Bob Lanier, so few saw him play of this era that obviously to some degree we're borrowing what previous generations have said, we're borrowing reputation issues there, and it's difficult. It's difficult to process somebody like that, for sure.
I'll just note, he was 68th in NBA rank. He came out 69th in championships added. So,
so you're right.
All right. Yeah, but that
very overrated.
But that's all based on box scores and assists, right? Like that is no component at all for team offensive or defensive performance, right?
No.
Yeah. Anybody else that popped out with you guys as being a little overrated before we get to the underrated guys and actually be positive for once?
Earl Monroe, that was one I wasn't necessarily expecting, per se, just knowing his reputation and, I mean, how amazing it was. But even in his, you know, Baltimore days, was never that great of a statistical player and didn't even get that much in terms of awards. He wasn't a top, you look strictly at the subjective awards component of these championships added, he's not a top 100 guy.
How much credit do you guys subjectively give to players who may not have been that amazing from a statistical standpoint, but really changed a lot of how the game was played? You could talk about Pete Maravich as that kind of guy. Earl Monroe obviously was an icon for a lot of players who really tried to emulate him and built on his ball handling wizardry, his shot making wizardry. Even like a Vince Carter, who is, you know, such an awesome dunker, but maybe not him as much because I don't think people, you know, built on the way that he played. But people like that who you can see their stylistic influence later, but maybe weren't that good themselves. Does that add anything to it for you guys?
I would endorse what he said about Earl Monroe, but to answer your question, I would say I think it's priced in to some degree, you know, with Pete Maravich, or, you know, it's difficult. These Bo Jackson type figures that we have who sort of either change the game or sort of redefine the limits of the game or something like that. It's really difficult to know what to do with that. I think the panel approach helps us there in that we get to hear from a lot of different people about how important that is. It's not just, you know, it's not just one person's opinion about how important that is. So it leads to some anomalies. I don't know if Pete Maravich should be 71, but at the same time, it would be strange to leave him off a list of the top 100, considering that at one point he was considered to have, you know, most unique skill set in the game.
Yeah, Bob Cousy is another one of those guys. He was at 39 on the list.
Right.
To me, this list is all about winning. And if those things don't matter towards winning, they don't matter towards my list. Now, I don't want to be, you know, Spock here. I don't know if people still call Zach Lowe that anymore. Like, obviously, I recognize that matters. It's just, to me, that's a different list than this one.
Well,
yeah,
I agree it's a different list. In fact, it's you know, it's a list we may work on. But I think that people... I would say the only thing I would want to add to that is that I do think that it's okay if people factor in, you know, special skills that they have that may not, you know, fit well into a formula. I don't really have a big problem with that. You know, you mentioned Vince Carter's dunking. You know, I don't have a big problem if people go, look, this is the greatest dunker we've ever seen since everybody for 50 years has tried to dunk the ball. That's worth thinking about. I don't have a really big problem with that.
Anybody who you guys thought was way too low?
I mean, I would say that there's a couple of classes. I don't know if there's necessarily as much classes of players who are overrated, but on the underrated side, you see, first off, the stars of the late 50s, early 60s, I think, is a group, certainly in terms of the difference between championships added and where they ranked on the NBA rank list, are dramatically underrated. You know, to me personally, I judge those guys based on whether they could still be successful after Bill Russell got into the league. To me, Bill Russell was like the line of demarcation between the earlier NBA that bore little resemblance to what we now know, where George Mikan was, you know, posting up forever because there was a smaller lane and just shooting over much smaller guys. And then, you know, at least by like 1960 or so, we have a relatively modern NBA. So anyone who could still be successful after that, like Bob Pettit, I think does deserve to be higher. The other group that...
Yeah, Bob Pettit, number 34, by the way.
Yeah, and he got more credit than someone like, let's see, where was I looking on my list?
Dolph Schayes, maybe?
Yeah, Dolph Schayes, who came out 23rd by my method, is 74th on the list. Paul Arizin, 35th on my method, 90th on the list. those few guys. The other group to me is ABA stars, and perhaps no one more than Artis Gilmore, who for a long time wasn't even in the Hall of Fame and is 29th in championships added. I tend to feel like I might not be penalizing the ABA performance quite enough to adjust for how poor the league was the first couple of years, but still I think that tends to get discounted probably more than it should.
Bob Pettit is the guy to me who is the most criminally underrated here. You mentioned whether he could have succeeded after Bill Russell came into the league, which was in 1956-57. He, along with Wilt, was one of the only two guys, only two stars to beat Russell in an epic series in 57-58 with the Hawks. I mean, his stats to me are every bit as good as someone like West or Oscar Robertson. He retired pretty early, you know, in 1965, but you know, was still going pretty darn strong. He was just experiencing a gentle decline at that point. I mean, to me, why is he 20 places lower, 25 places lower than someone like Oscar or Jerry West, who is pretty close to being a contemporary of, you know, and certainly had success at the same time that they did in equal measure?
I have Pettit a little lower because of that lack of longevity that you mentioned. But yeah, he just gets remembered differently because I think West gets considered a contemporary of, you know, the Russell Chamberlain group in a different way than Pettit does.
Yeah. Yeah, and also I think just because he's like a bald white guy who took hook shots. I mean, like, there's nobody, you know, Jerry West is the logo, Oscar averaged a triple-double, and there's no hook for Bob Pettit the way there is with some of these other guys, and obviously Jerry West and Oscar have both had post-career careers, I guess, in which they have remained in the news. So what do you think about that? Why do you think he is so much lower, Royce, than some of these other guys that I'm talking about?
Sorry, you're talking about Pettit?
Yeah.
You know, I really think that certainly, you know, players from the 50s or early 60s, you know, it's a bit of a blind spot because you are basically looking at box score stats and the box score stats that we have. So it's a little bit of a blind spot for this era because we don't have a lot of spectacular videos. Even you know, a Chamberlain or Russell, we at least have enough video that we've, you know, kind of worked it over the years watching NBA TV or ESPN Classic or ESPN, YouTube. You know, so I think it could be potentially a blind spot that we have. At the same time, I've already spoken about the fact that I don't think of that era as the same as this at all. So I don't really have as big a problem with it.
Anybody else that you guys felt is underrated? I mean, one class to me was some of these contemporary guests. I thought Chris Paul at number 29 is way too low.
Chris Paul is the name I was going to mention first. You know, I don't know if it's a class of players or just Chris Paul himself, but when you're in the conversation for best point guard of all time, it's a little strange to be 29th. I know, you know, Magic has dominated that conversation for a long time, but I don't know that Chris Paul is really an inferior player to Magic. Now, despite his slander earlier, Kevin did have a column saying that Curry had already surpassed Chris Paul, and I took that point seriously. But
Chris Paul, did I say that?
Well, you did. You said some version of that. Did I? Seems like I should know, but I might have misunderstood something.
Paul's much higher in championships added, and actually that was the point I was going to make earlier when we were discussing Steph Curry. Like, would you rather have 8 years of Steph Curry so far, or the 11 years of Chris Paul?
Yes, you're throwing
at a higher level for much longer.
You're throwing in the so far, and I'm not giving you the so far. But anyway, I think Chris Paul, if you're on the short list of the greatest point guards of all time, you know, and we can see, you know, just how great you are. We get to see it on a nightly basis. Of course, I think, you know, the fact that he hasn't reached the conference finals is always going to be held against him.
It was interesting to me that some current guys seem to get way more of a boost than you might expect based on where they are in their careers. Guys like Kevin Durant was number 22, Steph was 23. Paul, I think, should be higher, but he's still 29. Dwayne Wade, 27. You know, Wade is kind of down towards the end of his career. Maybe that's not a great example. But then guys like Chris Bosh, James Harden, Dwight Howard, even Amari Stoudemire, who didn't even make the top 100. I thought he probably should have been in there with how good those offenses were in Phoenix, even though he had a shorter peak. those guys, for whatever reason, didn't seem to get the benefit of the doubt. I mean, the fact that, like, Mo Cheeks, I think, is, like, higher than Chris Bosh or James Harden, that's pretty ridiculous to me.
I mean, I think what I'd say is...
Mo Cheeks is actually a little lower than Chris Bosh.
I think what I'd say is we have less perspective on the current players in some ways. So the guys that are playing really well right at the moment, I think, tended to get a bump from that. Kevin Love also being in the top 100 at this point in his career, another one that I think that's probably too much too soon for him. But if you're a guy that's not playing as well right now, like obviously Howard and Harden, we were doing this in December when the Rockets were enormous disappointments. I think that worked against both of those guys.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that could be a potential flaw. It could also be people trying to grapple with this new information we have about, you know, okay, Dwight Howard's not what we thought he was. What is he? Or so forth. So I'm of two minds about it. For one, you know, you don't want people to be too caught up in the moment. But at the same time, you do want them to be sensitive to what they're seeing lately from a player and trying to have some reasonable guess as to what that means. So, again, I think the panel approach helps with some of that, but you can never completely escape these little micro biases that jump in with, you know, sometimes there can be groupthink around a player. Sometimes there can be prisoner of the moment problems, that kind of thing. I don't think that Steph Curry, though, is a prisoner of the moment issue. I really think that people see him as such a new thing, and setting standards that we haven't seen before, that while 23rd may be high, may be low, whatever, it's people's honest attempt to grapple with how do you deal with a player who's playing that well. I mean, do you really want Scottie Pippen above, you know, Isaiah Thomas and Dwayne Wade above Steph Curry when they didn't peak as high?
So last question here before I let you guys go. Who are the players that you looked at? And Royce, it seems like this is something that would enter into your methodology a little bit more than it would Kevin's, especially because Kevin specifically said that it wouldn't. But who are the players who are more kind of creatures of their eras, or the type of guy who would be hurt the most by playing in a different era?
Kevin may have some good thoughts on that. Let me look at the list again.
I mean, the first thought that comes to my mind is probably the 80s small forwards, Bernard King, Alex English, even Adrian Dantley, although he might have been able...
Mark Aguirre is another good one of those guys, yeah.
Adrian Dantley might have been like a totally different player. He might have been a four throughout his career if he had come up now at 6'4". But those guys who didn't play much defense, it was kind of a mutual non-aggression pact, I feel like, to let each other get their 20 a night. And I don't know if that would fly now.
I don't know that, you know, I grew up there in the era of these great centers that we think about now with Akeem and Shaq and, you know, even Ralph Sampson, who was on the list, and Ewing and so forth. You know, Kareem was overlapped with that generation and so forth. So I don't know that they're really overrated, but it's striking. Oh, David Robinson, who's probably underrated on this list.
At number 20, David Robinson is underrated, huh?
Statistically speaking, I bet he finished better for Kevin. Where was he on your list, Kevin?
In terms of championships added, he was 17th, although part of that was 7th in the regular season.
He was one of the guys where, when I was saying that I thought this panel skewed towards people who are more into analytics, he was actually, him being number 20 was the first example that I thought of that had me making.
I think he suffers from reputational issues that are probably undeserved, but that's another conversation. I think when you have that generation of centers who set that standard so high and now everybody else is compared against them, it does make you wonder whether that just the style of play was giving them an advantage. But then again, if you watch David Robinson play, if you watch Akeem Olajuwon play, you can make the case for Ewing. You would say their skills would have translated. But
yeah, I think that there are not that many big men who have that type of skill level that they had, and even the athleticism of David Robinson. I mean, there, how many guys in the league can you name who look like David Robinson? You know, two, three. You know, I think those guys, it was just lucky that there were a lot of great centers during that period, and I think that they would translate fairly well, personally.
They probably would, but I do think that we have more skilled centers now than people, you know, people would never think of a Channing Frye, you know, as a great
center. Sure.
But he can do things those guys could never do. And it is an evolutionary game, and we don't know how well they would evolve. So it is a little fishy that we had that era pop up, and then with opening up the game more and allowing shorter players to thrive more, that that we don't anymore. You have to say that there probably was something in, I mean, I think we could say safely there was something about the game, the way the game was played, that gave them a bigger advantage than they would have had in the current era.
So yeah, how about for you, Kevin? Anybody else who pops out as you talked about those A small forwards? Are there any other guys that you look at as being, you know, much less effective now, or guys from now who would have been much less effective back then, or even guys who were less effective back then who would be more effective now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that topic is really intriguing to me, and I think it's a lot of guys who, you know, had skills that were uncommon to their position, where everything was so much putting guys in a box back then that I think now it would be very different. Like, imagine if, you know, Sam Perkins had come up and started shooting threes his entire career and still instead of waiting until he was in his 30s to start doing it.
One guy who actually really pops out to me as someone who I think would be awesome in today's era is Jerry West. I think, like, he would have learned to shoot threes. I mean, he was one of the best shooters of that era. Maybe Sam Jones is another guy, too, that would have been a really good three-point shooter. I thought he was actually a little bit too low as one of the best outside shooters of his era. And, you know, having won a bunch of championships, he was like 78 or something. But, yeah, I think any of those guys, I mean, the guys who shot, but, you know, were taking long twos because that was just the culture at the time instead of threes. I mean, those are the biggest category of guys that come out of it to me.
Well, Jerry West finished 13th, so we won't cry too hard. But yeah, I mean, the point's taken. I think Jerry West is an interesting guy because, you know, you look at him and, you know, obviously physically he's, you know, he's not flying and dunking, and, you know, you compare him to somebody like Klay Thompson, you can see that Thompson's athleticism is of a different kind and he shoots from farther out. But he is the kind of player who you can imagine those skills stretching, if only he played in a system or an era that encouraged that, because he certainly was prolific in that era when it was, you know, run up and down and shoot 15, 18 footers. So you can imagine that easily translating.
Okay, here's one. This is slightly different, but a question that I've been pondering over the past week. Who would be the modern, if George Mikan were dropped into the modern game, who do you think would be his closest NBA equivalent?
Oh, wow.
Hibbert?
that's where I went. I mean, because if Roy Hibbert was playing a bunch of, like, unathletic 6'8" guys, like, he would be an amazing player. He would totally win MVP.
They would have written poetry about Roy Hibbert. Yes.
Well, Roy Hibbert can actually block some shots, though. I don't think Mikan would even necessarily be able to do that.
That's true. Bill Russell had not yet invented the block shot.
But that's a good question.
Pretty good photo.
All right, are we about done here? I guess any other thoughts that you, Royce, especially you, as you devise this process, that things that you might want to try to improve in the future, or things that surprised you, anything you found particularly enjoyable about it?
I found the whole thing enjoyable. I think, you know, we don't need to talk about process a lot, but there was a lot of going back, and we built a ballot that's never been tried before for NBA rank last summer, and we built on that for this, where we set prior rankings. We went through a long, elaborate back and forth process to create this. And I think that, you know, I do hope that the listeners who have stayed with us for this long understand that it was our best and most honest attempt to get it right for the particular question that we were asking, and that it had, you know, real backbone from science and from, you know, mathematical principles. And, you know, it is analytics worthy for that reason. You're still factoring in human opinion and biases, and as the three of us discussed here, there are, you know, many valid ways to come to these, you know, opinions. But by aggregating all the opinions, I think that we came up with a list that, for the question we were asking, was about as definitive as it could be. So I feel great about that. I think what I would take forward is, you know, we would look and see all the things that Kevin has brought up and that you've brought up. We'd look and see, okay, are there biases that we can actually weed out? And are there ways to deal with some of these questions? But, you know, any flack that we've gotten has been mostly the flack that was always going to happen because of the results that we had and because of the way that we framed the question. But we really didn't want it to be about just career achievement and just about the past. We also wanted it to be about peak performance. So we wanted contemporary players to get their due, and we thought that would make the list far more meaningful, and in my opinion, it did. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah, Kevin, any thoughts that you had overall on this process?
I mean, I think the big takeaway to me is really we just don't spend enough time talking about NBA history. It's like, I mean, I think a great thing about the NBA is that there's a willingness to change. There's a willingness to embrace new things that doesn't exist in, let's say, baseball. But the flip side of that is we probably don't spend enough time talking about our history, which is such a big deal in baseball. Maybe partially because the Hall of Fame is so broken, and that's probably a podcast for another day. But I'm just glad that we spent this much time talking about the history of the league.
Yeah, me too. I think the biggest difference to me between baseball and basketball is that baseball pretty much looks the same now as it did almost 100 years ago, right? Like you're not like watching players, you know, maybe you could say pitchers like pitch a little bit differently. I'm not a baseball expert, but the style and the evolution is so much quicker and faster in basketball, where, you know, you're not just limited to specific positions and a pitcher and a batter and stuff like that, that I think it is easier to discount the past in basketball, and perhaps rightfully so, perhaps not, but that is really a great point, and I do enjoy NBA history a lot, and you're right too that it's just so hard. I mean, I didn't know anything about Bob Lanier until I started researching him, and despite the fact that I felt that he was overrated, I mean, I've watched maybe two games of him. That's all that's really been available to me. So it's there are a lot of these guys that we don't really know that much about, and that's kind of a shame, but it's always great to talk about this stuff with two experts in the field.
The pleasure was all on this side of the table.
Thanks, Nate.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for coming on, guys. Royce, where can we follow you on Twitter, by the way?
At Royce Webb, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. You must have been an early adopter
I was an early adopter. Should I put that in my bio?
I think that's like a point of pride to be an early adopter. And, of course, Kevin is at K Pelton as well. I am Nate Duncan, NBA. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you all next time.